A shooting attack in the occupied Al-Quds injures Israeli settlers amid tensions following recent aggression in Gaza and the West Bank. Meanwhile, Palestinian resistance groups hailed the Operation Al-Quds as a natural response to Israeli crimes and part of the struggle against occupiers. North Korea slams the UN chief's comments on the denuclearization of Pyongyang. It says his words lack impartiality and fairness. It's good to have you with us. Now, beginning this hour in the occupied East Al-Quds, where there's been a shooting incident, at least 9 people are said to have sustained injuries. 3 of them are in critical condition. The pre-dawn incident happened when a gunman opened fire on a bus in the old city of Al-Quds. Israeli officials branding it a terrorist attack. Gaza-based Palestinian resistance movements have hailed the attack as courageous. Hamas calls it a natural response to Israeli crimes against Palestinians and holy Muslim sites. The Islamic Jihad says this is part of resistance against the occupiers. Last week, a 3-day Israeli assault on the Gaza Strip killed some 50 Palestinians. The forces also recently stepped up raids in the West Bank, killing nearly 60 Palestinians since late March. In the same period, attacks on Israeli targets have also killed 19 people. From Ramallah, our correspondent Mona Kendil has the latest about the shooting attack.
Well, as you have mentioned, at least 9 Israeli settlers were wounded during this anti-Israel operation and shooting that was carried out early Sunday or after midnight Saturday in Al-Quds in 3 different parts of the old town of Al-Quds. A Palestinian opened fire using his gun at an Israeli bus, then an Israeli vehicle in Al-Quds. The Israeli soldiers raided Silwan neighborhood in Al-Quds and other neighborhoods in Al-Quds. They arrested a number of Palestinians, and later the Israeli military said that 28-year-old Palestinian Amir Saidawi from Al-Quds has turned himself to the Israeli soldiers or to the Israeli police after the Israeli troops arrested family members from Al-Quds. He turned himself in, and as well as his arm. According to the Israelis, this Palestinian young man is being interrogated, but according to some Israeli media, they are not 100% sure that he was the perpetrator. However, the interrogation is still going on.
In the Gaza Strip, our correspondent Ashraf Shannon tells us how the news of the Al-Quds attack was received in the blockaded Palestinian territory.
Palestinian resistance groups have welcomed the shooting operation in occupied Al-Quds, describing it as a heroic operation. Hamas spokesman Fawzi Barhoum said that the operation Al-Quds is a natural response to the arrogance of the Israeli regime and the crimes of its settlers and the daily attacks against Palestinians. And he also said that the Palestinians are fully aware that only resistance, specifically armed resistance, is the best way to fight the occupation and liberate Palestinian lands. Another Hamas official in charge of the Al-Quds file, Mohammed Hamada, he said that this operation comes in response to the massacre that the Israeli regime carried out in Gaza over a week ago, and also to the assassination of a Palestinian resistance fighter in Nablus.
Well, I had a conversation with political analyst Barry Grossman, and he believes that the Palestinians have every right to act in self-defense when they're being constantly attacked by Israeli troops.
You don't have to be an international lawyer. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to understand that if your neighbors, your family members, your people are constantly targeted by men in uniform with automatic weapons who shoot them dead, very often using snipers from a distance, shooting at children who are doing nothing that qualifies as a threat, it's only natural that there will come a breaking point at which people will respond against those who are tormenting them, and we're certainly well past that point, and we're now starting to see acts of armed resistance as matters escalate here in occupied Palestine, and of course it's only going to get worse. And it's not surprising that what we hear from the opposition is characterization of anything that Palestinians do as terrorism, while they continue to justify their murderous acts, their crimes against humanity committed by their own men in uniform under instructions from the highest level of the occupation government.
The Iranian foreign minister says that the language of threat used by the U.S. will not work against the Islamic Republic and its people. Hossein Amir Abdullahian urges the White House to stop playing the blame game. He says this won't bring the U.S. impunity from numerous terrorist crimes it's committed against thousands of Iranians and the wider region. On Thursday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken warned Iran of severe consequences if it attacks Americans, including former government officials. A day before, the U.S. Justice Department announced criminal charges against an Iranian national for allegedly recruiting an assassin to kill former National Security Advisor John Bolton. Tehran calls the allegations political and denies any involvement in any such plot. North Korea criticizing the UN chief for complete and verifiable denuclearization. The North has dismissed the remarks by Antonio Guterres as dangerous, accusing him of supporting the hostile policy adopted by the U.S. According to Pyongyang, the UN chief's comments lack impartiality and fairness. North Korea says an irreversible denuclearization of the country would be a breach of its sovereignty. Guterres, who was in South Korea on a two-day visit, expressed his commitment to denuclearization of the North, calling it a fundamental objective to bring peace, security, and stability to the whole region. Washington and Seoul have for a while raised concerns about Pyongyang preparing to perform what would be its seventh nuclear test. Now, speaking of Korea, thousands of South Korean progressives and unionists have gathered in downtown Seoul to protest joint U.S.-South Korea military drills, scheduled to begin on August 22nd. Labor leaders call for an end to such drills, warning that the Korean Peninsula is inching toward a nuclear war. Frank Smith reports.
Thousands of South Korean unionists and their progressive supporters rallied in downtown Seoul to protest against joint U.S.-South Korea war games planned for later this month. The drills will be the largest in years and follow the May election of President Yoon Suk-yeol, who's promised to take a hard line with North Korea. Union leaders worry about risks.
The threat of nuclear war is growing on the Korean Peninsula. Conservative forces of Yoon Suk-yeol in South Korea and those in the U.S. are frantically conducting aggressive war drills in the sky, the land, and the sea, and are about to start large-scale joint military exercises aimed at the invasion of North Korea. We must stamp out this behavior of anti-reunification forces.
While many South Koreans, especially supporters of President Yoon on the right, favor close ties with the U.S., large numbers also argue the U.S. military and the country's alliance with Washington prevent the improvement of ties with North Korea and generate tension.
We not only oppose the war exercises, but we want the U.S. forces, Korea, which is actually controlling and interfering with the Korean Peninsula, to leave this land. We believe that only then will the 80 million Koreans from both North and South be able to live peacefully.
The drills will reportedly involve a U.S. aircraft carrier strike group with extensive field training to include amphibious maneuvers. South Korea has also been training alongside U.S. forces with recently acquired American F-35 Joint Strike Fighters. In an effort to strengthen the U.S.-South Korea alliance, military officials from Seoul and Washington will meet to discuss the deployment of U.S. strategic assets and extended deterrence, which refers to the deployment of U.S. nuclear weapons in the defense of South Korea. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Salman Rushdie, the author of a highly controversial anti-Islam book, has reportedly been taken off the ventilator. He is not able to talk. That a day after he was seriously wounded in an attack. Rushdie was stabbed on stage during an event in New York on Friday. The 24-year-old suspect, Hadi Matar, has pleaded not guilty to charges of attempted murder and assault. A lawyer entered a plea on his behalf during a formal hearing at a court in New York. Prosecutors are remanding Matar, who is from New Jersey, in custody without bail. Rushdie published his sacrilegious novel, The Satanic Verses, in the late 80s. The blasphemous passages in the book triggered an outcry across the Muslim world. Political commentator Mohsen Abbas says that Salman Rushdie was a tool in the hands of the West to confront Islam.
On an individual level, he'd kind of outlived his usefulness. I guess Rushdie takes the inauspicious honor or denigration of being, the first potential tool of Western neoliberal deep state in that process of its war on Islam. On Islam, the real Islam which talks about justice and talks about governments which should be just and talks about a system which is, you know, anti-usurious, perhaps, anti-corruption, anti-exploitation of the masses.
Studies into hate crimes in Austria have revealed that anti-Muslim hate is on the rise in that country. But perhaps most shocking of all is that Islamophobic hate crimes appear to have increased sharply following government initiative to uproot what it calls political Islam. Robert Carter is in Vienna to investigate more.
Austria is famous for its stunning architecture and artistic legacy, boasting to be the home of the great German composers, including Mozart and Beethoven. Sadly, however, Austria has built up another reputation in recent years, that of growing intolerance towards its Muslim minority. According to data released in June 2022, over 1,000 Islamophobic incidents were reported the previous year, a shocking increase which has grown year upon year. Research into anti-Muslim hate crimes in Austria have found that the overwhelming majority of the incidents which take place has been men targeting women, with a staggering 69% of victims being female, many of whom wear the hijab. However, it's not just on the street level where the targeted harassment of Muslims is taking place. The sharp spike of 2021 was allegedly assisted by the controversial state-implemented Islam map, introduced by authorities to highlight the location of all mosques across Austria. Critics believe it aided in the spread of hate crimes.
I don't think you can name a single visibly Muslim person in this country that hasn't been verbally attacked or even physically. And I try to not give a lot of attention to the individual attacks they face, because that would just be, that would just...
Although it was hard to relive the experience, Iman doesn't believe in playing the victim, instead focusing on the root cause.
Focusing on a single perpetrator and focusing my anger towards him would be very weakening, in my opinion, because in the end he has fallen victim to the narrative that the state has given him about us being a threat.
In November 2020, Austrian authorities launched Operation Luxor, which saw homes and offices of Muslim charities and activists raided as part of a so-called war on political Islam. But critics claim its only achievement is dehumanizing Muslims and fueling growing public fear towards Islam. An increase in fear almost certainly leads to more hate. Robert Carter, Vienna.
In an unprecedented incident, the FBI searched former President Trump's residence in Florida. A search warrant, unsealed by Judge, says the top secret files were seized from his estate. Trump is accused of violating rules on official record, something that he denies. The former president and his Republican allies have accused the FBI of being corrupt and politicized.
The U.S. Justice Department says FBI agents have found 11 sets of classified documents, with some marked as top secret, in Trump's Mar-a-Lago home in Florida while executing a search warrant this week. The warrant was publicly released following a federal judge's order. It states investigators had probable cause to believe Trump violated three federal crimes, including violating the Espionage Act, obstruction of justice, and criminal handling of the government records. Media reports say the FBI search of Trump's Mar-a-Lago home was for possible classified materials related to U.S. nuclear weapons. Trump, however, rejected that. He called it a hoax and claimed he had no stored classified information. The unprecedented raid on the residence of the former U.S. president provoked a backlash from leading Republicans who described the move as politically motivated. The Florida governor, Ron DeSantis, said the search of Trump's property was another escalation in the weaponization of federal agencies against the regime's political opponents. Also, Florida Senator Marco Rubio stated that Biden is using his power to persecute Trump. But the White House has denied the allegations, saying it was unaware of the search before it happened. Moreover, there have been growing threats in recent days against FBI agents and offices across the country. On Thursday, a man who tried to breach the FBI's Cincinnati office was shot and killed by police after he fled the scene. Law enforcement officials say the man may have been present at the January 6th riot. Right after news of the FBI search of Mar-a-Lago broke, there was a big spike in tweets referencing civil war. Analysts and reporters say this is alarmingly similar to the activities in the lead-up to the January 6th attack on the Capitol.
Well, I think it's true that there are people in the permanent national security wing of the U.S. government who don't want Trump to return to office. And whether or not those people are currently raiding Trump in Mar-a-Lago in order to try to get proof of crimes they could use to charge him and put him in a position where he legally can't run for office.
And with that, we come to this broadcast from Tehran.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Aperture.
Welcome back. The first part of the show went to Israel's Negev Desert to reveal Dimona's hidden secrets. Dimona's core reactor is made of cement-coated metal. The fuel rods are inserted into the core where nuclear fusion takes place. Now, over the years, core absorbs tremendous amounts of heat and radiation, which slowly cause a degeneration of its materials. A Dimona core, which was put into action back in 1963, was intended to be operational for up to 40 years, but it's exceeded the intended time frame by over a decade now. In fact, Israel is least threatened by the Dimona, having its population living in the north far from the reactor. 95% of the wind direction in Palestine is northwesterly, away from the Israeli localities, but towards Jordan and Palestine. Mordechai Benunu, the Israeli nuclear scientist and whistleblower, has long stated in interviews that Dimona's chimneys do not operate unless the wind blows in the direction of Jordan, and that Jordan should test residents in areas just across the border from the Dimona to be sure they've not already been exposed to radiation.
Israeli nuclear program is surrounded by a novel atmosphere. Arnon Milchan is a famous Hollywood producer behind films like Pretty Woman, Club of Fighters, or L.A. Confidential. He was also good friends with Shimon Peres and Benjamin Netanyahu. Recently, he revealed his double life. During all these years, he worked as a Mossad agent, helping Israel to buy technology needed to make nuclear weapons. Under a Hollywood producer cover, he was actually a kind of godfather of Israel's nuclear program. But there is no story like that of Mordechai Vananus. Vananu was a nuclear technician in Dimona till 1985. Before quitting, he snapped two rolls of film at the top-secret nuclear plant. The world was stunned when the Sunday Times published Vananu's story and photos, exposing for the first time the secrets of Israel's nuclear arsenal in October 1986. But Israeli intelligence found Mordechai Vananu, and they waited for the right moment to strike. Sent a woman agent to seduce Mordechai Vananu in London and convince him to travel with her to Rome. Vananu was vulnerable and afraid and fell for Mossad's honey trap. The article was published on October the 5th, 1986. Vananu had vanished. His kidnap, an illegal act on foreign soil, was kept secret. Later, when Vananu appeared for a secret court session in Jerusalem al-Quds, he found a way to reveal what had happened to him since he left London. Writing on his hand, Vananu M was hijacked in Rome. Vananu's trial was held in secret. He was found guilty of treason and espionage and sentenced to 18 years in jail, 11 of them in solitary confinement. The woman that seduced Vananu was Cheryl Benthor. After she completed her mission, she disappeared back into her secret world. Today, she lives back in Orlando, USA, with her husband and two daughters, running a real estate business. Vananu's revelations confirmed suspicions and showed a weapons program bigger and more advanced than anyone had previously thought. Mordechai Vananu was released in 2004, but he is not a free man. Israeli borders are now his prison. His passport was confiscated and he cannot contact foreigners.
This Jewish state have 200 atomic weapons, have hydrogen bomb, atomic weapons, neutron bomb, and they are not able to say they have the bomb. They are not able to destroy anyone. They are not able to use the bomb. Instead, they arrest Vanunu Mordechai.
Dimona's symbol, the only building seen from far away. A 20 meters high nuclear reactor dome. In 1986, Vanunu took us inside. A heavy water reactor built in the 50s with France and Norway's help, with a capacity of 24 megawatts. Thanks to Vanunu, we learned that this reactor capacity is three or possibly even five times larger than assumed. This reactor produces 40 kilograms of plutonium a year, enough to build 10 to 12 atomic bombs. Adjacent to the reactor is Institute Number 3. Here, the fuel rods powering the reactor are produced, together with lithium-6, another ingredient of the bomb. Institute Number 5. Here, the fuel rods are coated with the aluminium. Institute Number 6 is the power station of the compound. The lab is in Institute Number 8, and inside is another secret revealed by Mordechai Vanunu. This is where Israel produces enriched uranium. Like plutonium, it's conserved as fissionable material for the bomb. The uranium is produced through gas centrifuges. Enriched uranium is also produced in Institute Number 9 using laser, a unique Israeli patent. Institute Number 10 produces the depleted uranium, an important component in the production of armor-piercing shells. Institute Number 4 handles the radiation waste prior to it being disposed. And long two-story building with no windows is Dimona's biggest secret. Institute Number 2. Beneath the two innocent-looking floors, hidden underground, are six additional floors. It was Vanunu who showed the world what no satellite could see. Here, Israel set up a plutonium separation facility with one goal, the manufacturing of atomic bombs. In the 60s, American inspectors visited the first floor. They saw the restaurants and the offices. A special wall was constructed, hiding the elevators leading to the underground levels. Back outside, trucks bring in the processed uranium rods. Through the large doors, a crane grasps the rods and lowers them to the big workspace four floors below. The rods are dipped in nitrous acid tanks, cooked for about 30 hours, and then a system of pipes draws the water containing the uranium and plutonium. Through a chemical process, the materials are separated and then baked in an oven, producing a small 130-gram plutonium ball, 1.7 kilograms a week, 4 kilograms, and it's a bomb. Just shot by Vanunu. The process can be viewed from level 2. A balcony was built for distinguished guests, nicknamed Golda's Balcony. And that's the control room as shot by Vanunu. Only 150 employees are authorized to enter it. Visits are limited to the Prime Minister, the Ministry of Military Affairs, and a small group of confidants. Equipped with a hidden camera, Vanunu walked about Institute Number 2 and took pictures of the different sections. Not only plutonium is produced here. At level number 4, Vanunu revealed the production of tritium used in the production of thermonuclear bombs, which are more powerful than ordinary atomic bombs. Two other essential materials for the bomb are produced here, lithium and deuterium. All these ingredients are taken to level 5, to unit MD2, the metal department, where they are assembled into a bomb. One level down is a recreation room where Vanunu shot what experts identified as a model of an Israeli thermonuclear bomb. 10 times more powerful than the bomb dropped on Hiroshima. Experts that analyzed Vanunu's testimony determined that by the 80s, Israel had produced 100 to 200 atomic bombs. This ranks Israel as the sixth or even fifth nuclear power in the world. From Amman, we travel to southern Jordan. High cancer rates were recorded in all the southern Jordanian governorates, which confirms the possible direction of nuclear dust that might be leaking from Dimona. Tips we received claim that in Jordan there are hundreds of cases of cancer and other diseases, all of them in the regions near the border with Israel. From Tal Afar to Dimona, it is about 30 kilometers, and winds or water knows no borders. In almost every house in this region, we can find the same story, diseases and death. Dimona is a word that everybody knows around here. But in Jordan, like in Israel, Dimona and its deadly consequences are a taboo. Saleh is a tour guide and an activist. For years, he is trying to uncover what is happening to the people around the Tafila region. Our next stop is in Tafila. Here, the average manifestation of cancer is higher than the other Jordanian governorates and surrounding Arab countries. Going to visit the governor's office, where we are going to meet the mayor and the governor of the region. It's a surprise what we are going to hear. People around Tafila region are dying from cancer in high numbers. The doctors link the cases to Dimona contamination. But officially, nobody can say it, not even the ones that are dying. Dana is an amazing natural treasure in Jordan, too close to Dimona. Bassem Saudi was born here, in this land, a step away from Dimona nuclear plant. Yeah. He knows that his people are dying silently and wants answers that never come. Is Dimona nuclear plant poisoning its Arab neighbors? While we were filming with Bassem Saudi, some guards at the Dana Natural Reserve approach us. They want to break their silence. They also have a story to tell about how Dimona is killing their families. We are back in Palestine to visit some villages south of Al-Khalib, very close to the Negev Desert and Dimona. Here, the cancer rates are growing in alarming numbers. The causes are not more than rumors. Nuclear radioactive leakage from Dimona and nuclear waste dumps in the area, or even both. We try to find a clear answer to these rumors in Berlin with Xantha Hall.
200 cubic meters a year were produced in Dimona, and it's been running for more than 40 years. We can estimate about 8,000 cubic meters of radioactive waste have been, as the bottom line, have been produced. And to try and imagine what that is, that's maybe, in a picture, 50,000 standard barrels of oil would be about 8,000 cubic meters. We also don't know where they bury this waste. They say that it's not far from the reactor, and the main problem that we're looking at here is what state are these stainless steel containers in? Are they corroded? Will they be leaking? Are they seeping into the ground, into the water sources? Are we seeing pollution of the environment, therefore of people's health? I mean, I don't know exactly the geography of the area, but and there it's chalk, and I imagine that the whole area is probably also chalk, and that is not a good area to be deposing any kind of waste. And they saw that with this toxic waste dump, because there was leakages and serious health problems were discovered. So I would imagine that it would be similar in the area around Dimona, because it's not far away. And also whether it gets into the water or not, because once it gets into the water, then it transports much further into other areas and people can drink it that are quite far away. So then we're talking about basically that there would be cancers later on, or leukemia, and in particularly the children would be badly affected, because children and especially women are more susceptible to radiation. The effects on them are much greater than grown men, for instance. I would say that those are the ones that we have found, definitely in the studies that have been done around nuclear installations in Germany, that the main problem was childhood cancer. And in the areas surrounding plutonium reprocessing plants like Sellafield in the UK, the main problem was leukemia.
The radioactivity has a tremendous power that can penetrate the human gene, affecting generation after generation. Jamal is a Palestinian policeman. He was arrested after the Second Intifada and spent 13 years in jail. Now he is free, but living a new hell. His daughter has cancer. At the age of 9, she was diagnosed with leukemia. Nothing in the medical report says this Palestinian girl is a direct victim of Dimona. But she comes from an area that counts 70% of cancer cases among the Palestinian population. Israel is probably the 6th or even 5th nuclear power in the world. While others should open the doors of their nuclear programs for inspections, Israel is a special case, producing nuclear weapons since the 60s without any control. Meanwhile, the cancer cases and other diseases are spreading across Israel, Palestine and neighboring Arab countries. The victims die without knowing what or who is killing them.
Well, even if Dimona's deadly weapons of mass destruction are never used, still, the reactor has been silently killing masses of defenseless citizens throughout the decades, and it continues doing so. By continuing to maintain and operate the Dimona reactor, Israel is committing a crime against humanity that will be added to the atrocities that is perpetrated throughout its history. And that's it for this week, everyone. Until another episode of Aperture, it's goodbye.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful, dear friends, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, you are listening to Lantern. We have an interesting story. Horeb ibn Yazid Riyahi. Horeb ibn Yazid was a carrier officer in the Kufa army. As a professional soldier, he did not very much concern himself with what he considered to be political issues. His duty, he felt, was to execute the order of his superiors. However, lurking somewhere in that stout military heart was an Islamic conscience. Horeb ibn Yazid and his soldiers met Imam al-Hussein and his companions at a place a few miles outside Kufa. It was midday when the two parties met. Hor and his people had been traveling since morning and were very thirsty. He requested Imam al-Hussein for water for his army. Imam Hussein asked Hazrat Abbas and the others to give Hor and his men water and also to give water to their horses. This must have been a poignant scene. Water bottles being brought out of the saddle bags and the youth pouring water for Yazid's army to quench their thirst. Zuhr prayer, well led by Imam and Hor and his soldiers, joined in. After the prayers, Hor told Imam al-Hussein that his orders were to stop Imam al-Hussein from going to Kufa unless he agreed to give bay'ah, that means swear allegiance, to Yazid. Imam al-Hussein said that he would never give bay'ah to Yazid. Imam Hussein could have fought Hor and his soldiers and forced his way into Kufa, but he did not wish to start any battle. He told Hor that he would take another route and go away from Kufa. Hor said that his orders were to follow Imam al-Hussein, and so followed by Hor and his 1,000 soldiers, Imam al-Hussein and his companions rode in the direction away from Kufa. On the 2nd of Muharram, they reached Karbala. Imam Hussein bowed lander and put up his tents. Hor and his men pitched these camps some distance away. The following day, Umar ibn Sa'd came to Karbala with 4,000 soldiers. On the night of Ashura, Hor was very restless. He could hear the children in Imam al-Hussein's camp cry because of thirst. He began to think, "What have I done? Why did I put the son of Fatima in this position?" Hor, his son, and his slave rode over to Imam al-Hussein's camp. Hor threw himself at Imam al-Hussein's feet, pleading for his forgiveness. Imam Hussein took Hor in his arms and said, Hor, I forgive you. I assure you that my grandfather, the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him also, forgives you. Hor then asked Imam al-Hussein for permission to go and fight the enemies of Islam. Imam Hussein said, Hor, you are my guest. How can I let you die for me? Hor insisted. Hor went to the battlefield, and after a valiant fight, he fell and was killed. His son and his slave were also killed. Dear brothers and sisters, accept our sorrow and condolences on the month of Muharram. I invite you to listen to the continuation of this program, Lantern. Dr. Fakhr Rohani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, Rabbi Nestein. In this episode, we are going to be concerned with certain aspects of the life and times of Al-Hurr ibn Yazid al-Riyahi. When Al-Hurr ibn Yazid al-Riyahi joined the camp of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, he received the warm appreciation and welcome of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Although Al-Hurr ibn Yazid al-Riyahi had intercepted Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and prevented him from reaching Al-Kufa, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam never asked him of his reasons for doing so, of his reasons for intercepting his way and doing so. Rather, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam appreciated his joining him. And Al-Hurr ibn Yazid al-Riyahi from that time on, from that moment on, became a soldier of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. What's important in this regard is that the magnet of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam was so powerful Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam attracted not a simple soldier from the camp of the Umayyad forces, rather he absorbed a famous dignitary, an army commander from the side of the Umayyad forces. It must be asserted here that it wasn't only Al-Hurr ibn Yazid al-Riyahi who joined the camp of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, rather Al-Hurr ibn Yazid al-Riyahi's son and some of his servants and soldiers also joined Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, because Al-Hurr ibn Yazid al-Riyahi was a very high-ranking military general and a military commander on the side of the Umayyads. Noteworthy is that on the day of Ashura, according to authentic reports, several people from the Umayyad side joined Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. However, none of the companions of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam joined the Umayyad camp. And it shows that the Umayyad camp, although very large and very, magnificent in number, was absolutely devoid of any attractions, so that it's indicated that the side of Umar ibn Sa'd wasn't that interesting to attract people from the side of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
On the other hand, it must be asserted also that the camp of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, people intended to join Imam al-Hussein Sam, and they certainly joined Imam al-Hussein Sam for the sake of achieving felicity in the world hereafter. All of them had been ready for martyrdom. However, on the camp of, in the camp of the Umayyad forces, people were over there all based on some promises. I mean, all the promises that later on proved in vain to be rewarded by the Umayyad authorities. Another point in this connection is that when Al-Hurr ibn Yazid al-Riyahi was martyred, Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam appreciated his martyrdom and expressed that he was really a liberal-minded person, as his mother had named him so. In connection with this point, it's indicated, I mean, in history books, that when Al-Hurr ibn Yazid al-Riyahi was shot and fell down, Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam came forward and then took a handkerchief out of his own pocket and put it on the wound on the forehead of Al-Hurr ibn Yazid al-Riyahi. And this was, as indicated in history books, I mean, it was, I mean, ascertained, it was, I mean, proved that it was really the case, because several centuries later, I mean, around more than 150 years ago, when one of the Qajar kings visited Karbala and wanted to renew the mausoleum and shrine of Al-Hurr ibn Yazid al-Riyahi, they started digging the grave, and they reached the body of Al-Hurr ibn Yazid al-Riyahi. They found the body intact, wounded but intact, not deteriorated. And that Qajar king, the minute he noticed the handkerchief that was originally that of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, wanted to take it out for himself. I mean, the forehead of Al-Hurr ibn Yazid al-Riyahi started bleeding. And it's important in this connection, it's noteworthy in that connection, that Al-Hurr ibn Yazid al-Riyahi was an instance of a person whose sinful past turned within a few moments into a very brilliant future and felicity. Thank you.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. Ala bi dhikrillah tatma'innul qulub.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.